This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Remember that anxiety trying to fit in as an adolescent? You're growing up. There is this angst-ridden struggle to figure out who you are and how you fit. Now imagine trying to navigate three worlds and cultures. Andrew Agapur was raised in the 80s by immigrant parents in Charleston, South Carolina. Mom, a British Christian, dad, a Muslim from Iran. Andrew was raised all of the above. Andrew shares stories of anxiety, asthma, and growing up multiracial, multireligious, and multicultural in his new one-person show, Zara. It premieres Thursday at PSI Theater at the Durham Arts Council. Andrew Agapur is a comedian, a storyteller, and he has a PhD in religious studies from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks for joining us, Andrew. Good to see you again.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
What a combo. I mean, just that, you know, a comedian and a religious scholar.
Yeah, odd combination, I suppose.
With that, what do you like on your tax return?
Funny
religious.
Right, I can write off every joke as long as it's funny.
All right, so take us back to growing up in Charleston.
Yeah, I was born in 1985 in Charleston, South Carolina, and yeah, this show is about growing up in these three different worlds at once. On the one hand, I came of age in the American South. You know, I was a child in the 90s, which was a pretty good time. We had Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers and multiracial Power Rangers, which was empowering for me at the time. And I don't know if you remember, but in the 90s, everybody was playing the saxophone. President Clinton, Kenny G, California Raisins. And
not everybody.
Well, to my mind, it was. And since my parents were immigrants, yeah, I thought it was an American thing. So I would go over to my friends' houses and be like, hey, do your parents have a saxophone so I can play it? Mm. Because I didn't realize that it wasn't that every single American had one.
I see. What kind of answers were you getting? Are they just looking at you funny?
Well, yeah, I got a lot of funny looks. And I was always trying to figure out, what is American culture all about?
Really, when did this finally occur to you? Because it's true, on the one hand, if you grow up in a multicultural society, and you maybe tell us a little bit more about your parents. I just gave it a gloss.
Yeah, but yeah. Thanks for asking. So my mother is British. She's Christian, and she came to America when she was 8 years old. Her family bought a one-way set of tickets for the four of them. They crossed the Atlantic, and she remembers seeing the Statue of Liberty emerge on the horizon as they came into Ellis Island. My father came to the United States in 1978, escaping the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And he is a pious, practicing Muslim who fled that chaos and had the experience of being on the last flight out of Iran before they shut down the airports during the revolution. And so they raised me in Charleston, South Carolina, you know, not trying to simplify things, but with these two different rich cultural and religious histories. And I was just trying to figure it out and, you know, use my humor to survive and make sense of it all.
You know, it must have been an interesting challenge for your father, now that I think about it. He's escaping a revolution which is about Islamic fundamentalism. This is about recapturing and redefining our image as Muslims. And so there's nothing more definite and image-driven, identity-driven.
Yes.
Than that. He flees that, but he's a practicing Muslim. He doesn't want to abandon that. It's just that he didn't fit in that particular.
Exactly. That's such a great example of the important nuances of religion, that he had to flee the chaos and the kind of absolutism of that revolution. And the Iranian revolution could have gone different ways. It was a chaotic moment. The kind of fundamentalist Islamicists came into power. He knew that he could not survive there. He was a restaurateur, and he witnessed as restaurants were being burned to the ground if they sold alcohol. And so he knew that he couldn't make a living there, couldn't survive there. On the way out, he got hit by a car, broke a vertebra in his back, and came to the United States a refugee with a cane and some worthless reals in his pocket.
And he decides to start a restaurant here.
He did. And that's that classic story that many immigrants have to be entrepreneurs, because that's, you know, it's hard to get work, but you can always be your own boss.
That's how we met your mom.
Exactly. He needed somebody to make sure that the menu made sense, because he didn't speak great English. And so we hired her, and that's how they met.
I once went to a Latino restaurant. It was a great, really nice restaurant, but It was a Latino restaurant run by, I think, Lao refugees. Mm. And so on the, so what you got is this kind of amalgamation of Spanish and English. And we were offered on that particular menu, polio chicken. I think it was supposed to be polo, but you can see, I can see right away that when polio gets the extra vowel, suddenly you don't want to eat.
You know, and my parents, one of their first restaurants, the first one that really made it big was an Italian restaurant. And I asked my dad, why did a British person and an Iranian person start an Italian restaurant? And his answer was super entrepreneurial immigrant. It was, well, you know, pasta has really great profit margins. It's just flour and water.
There you
it's like,
go.
That's really easy.
Makes sense. So at what point then do you start to realize that this, because as a kid, this is the air you breathe. It's the flour and water that you eat. So, but at some point you notice, right? When did you start noticing? Was it the saxophone questions?
The saxophone questions. I started kind of realizing my difference in a lot of ways, realizing you know, where the things were different about me than other folks. I remember, just coming to the top of my head, I remember having the distinct realization that the good guys in movies looked like my friends' dads and the bad guys in movies looked like my dad. And why was that? And that was a tricky thing to figure out. I also had a great experience growing up in the South. There's so many great things about Southern culture and the way that Southern culture does bring people together. My family was embraced by the Charleston community, especially after Hurricane Hugo, when the city was in disarray and my father opened up the kitchen and just started feeding anyone who was hungry because the generator was out, the food was going to spoil, let's just give everything to the community. And so the South was also a very accepting place to be.
So all of these currents come together in you. You embody these and begin to artistically render them in your one-person show.
Yes.
And I wonder if you can give us a sample right now.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I'll tell you a little something about myself that you mentioned at the top. That I'm a very anxious person. And there is a story that gets told a lot in my family. My parents love this story, and it's about my first day of kindergarten. So my mom drops me off, comes back a few hours later to pick me up, and the teacher took her aside because she was pretty concerned. She said, so I introduced the kindergartners to the new classroom. I said, here are the cubbies, here's the bathroom, here's the reading corner. And I asked if there were any questions. Andrew raised his hand first and asked two questions. First, when I get a house, do I need to get one made out of brick or wood? And second question, what is health insurance and how do I get it? And my parents wondered what was going on in my head, and I know exactly what was going on, which is that I'm an anxious person. Mm. I thought school was forever. I thought there's no more going home. I don't even have pajamas. I got to get things straight. So I decided the first thing I need to ask is, how do I build a shelter? Mm-hmm. And that anxiety is something I make light of in the show. It's something that carried me through to my understandings of religion and my obsession with the facts. I'm someone, because of my anxiety, I want to get the facts straight. And religion is kind of famously difficult to lay down and turn into a perfectly rational thing. And so my experience as a scholar of religion and as a practitioner of religion is informed by this impulse to try to get things straight and get out all the facts.
Well, how did you practice growing up? I mean, talk about that. Church in the South, that's a big deal. And you always get points. Certainly in the South, in North Carolina, it had always been whatever church you, by and large, whatever church you embraced, you became church folk, and which is how Jewish communities often reflect their experience here. We've seen that happen a couple of times where Jewish communities will talk about being embraced because they were church folk.
Yeah, my that's such a great point. My experience of religion in the South was a kind of Muslim version of that. My family helped found the first immigrant mosque in Charleston. And at that time in Charleston, since there was such a diffuse Muslim population, it meant that there were families from so many different cultures, from across the Middle East, the Balkans, Europe, Africa. And so it meant that we, you know, rented a small building where we would practice, But it meant that going to different families' homes on Friday nights, it was different cuisines, very different experiences. But we all kind of had that shared commonality of practicing Islam.
Talking to Andrew Agapur, he's got a one-person show called Zara, which premieres Thursday at PSI Theater at the Durham Arts Council, followed by a post-show panel discussion. And I wonder if you can give us another sample right here.
I'd be happy to. So I'm actually going to tell you a little bit about my experience having my religion challenged. So I went to the College of Charleston, also in South Carolina, just a few blocks from my home. And it was a different experience. You know what it's like. You go to college, you get to experiment with these taboo substances like alcohol and bacon, in my case. I never tried bacon before. And I was not sure about my Islam. I was a little bit on the fence. I didn't know what to categorize myself as anymore. And then on my very first day of college, I went to the cafeteria. I didn't know anybody yet, so I was by myself. Got a tray, went up to the breakfast buffet, and there I saw a giant steaming pile of bacon. That didn't sound appetizing, but it looked very appetizing. I see the bacon. I go up to it. I remember I put one piece on its own plate because I didn't want it to touch any of the other food. You know, I was raised with this prohibition against pork, and so it really did seem like a taboo substance, and yet I was driven to try it. I took it to a seat that was kind of off. I was by myself and wanted to have privacy. I remember smelling the bacon, and it had this kind of smoky applewood brimstone smell to it that I just knew smelled like sin. And I took one bite, and I immediately declared myself an atheist because it was so good. Like, how could there be a just and loving God who didn't want me to eat this delicious thing? And my religion has since changed from that moment of bacon-induced nihilism, but it was a big moment for me.
Talk more about that, the idea, because this show in so many ways is about identity, and it's about you sort of trying to navigate these worlds. The anxiety it may have produced on top of whatever anxiety you brought into this world all by yourself. But talk about that, because it's very important. Obviously, it is the source of much conflict. People will fight wars over these identities. Having been in the, and so for those of us who are just brought up a certain way, you know, you don't always think about it. Have you given any thought to how it is that we have attached ourselves to these things? With the central question, if there was one God, why were there so many options for failure here and so many rules that clearly other subjects and other parts of that God's creation don't abide by?
That's a great question. I opened the show with a joke about how monotheism has always been confusing to me at a fundamental level, though I respect it. There is something odd to me about saying that there's just the one God. And so I opened the show with the Persian prophet Zarathustra, the very first monotheist in recorded history, 1500 BCE. Before Moses, before Jesus, there was Zarathustra, born not too far from where my father was born. And so I go to him first to ask, who was the first person to say there's one God? I'm going to stake my identity on one absolute truth. And to me, it's a bold move. To say that you've got the absolute truth. It'd be like if we were in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and I said, hey, only Thor. Thor's the only superhero. Iron Man doesn't exist. Captain Marvel doesn't exist. It's only Thor. Thor's it. But what I work through in the show is how do we make sense of absolute truth in our current moment where we are in this kind of what I would call, as a scholar, I think we're in the kind of the death throes of absolute truth. And that's what this truthiness, fake news moment looks like, where we're trying to figure out how do we go from the absolute truth of religion and what we also had as the kind of supposed absolute truth of science to some new place where we can have shared truths together that aren't capital T truths, mm-hmm. but lowercase t truths. And that's a really tough question because if we stake our identities on capital T truths, that can lead to conflict. This show is about my struggle to make sense of inheriting a lot of capital T truths and turning them into some lowercase t truths of my own.
It's interesting. Zarah is the name of the show, named for not only that prophet, Zarathustra, but also the famous tract written by Nietzsche, who addressed the very same subject, right?
Exactly. Yeah, this show is kind of a love note to Nietzsche. My producer is cringing hearing me say that. That's not a good...
me too, by the way.
I think that Nietzsche taught us a lot about how to live in a world creatively. And so I explore through Nietzsche's thinking, and this prophet that he proposed, his second Zarathustra, who he named after the first, who doesn't say there's no God so much as... if there's no God, how do we live? How do we make sense of the world?
Yeah, and the tricky part for him, and I think why Nietzsche may be so widely and very differently understood, I won't say misunderstood, because I don't think I understand, but I know that there are wide variations in how people understand, is that what is sad about modern life is our loss of a sense of wonder, awe, and the power of the irrational. Not that there is a divine angry God who has prescribed everything for us, but that we can't live in wonder and embrace the irrational.
Exactly. And that's so well put. And that's exactly what the show is about. And in the end of the show, we explore exactly that, some of the experiences that I've had of awe and wonder, and how to recognize that those exist in the universe and are things that we can appreciate.
Great stuff. Andrew, thank you so much for bringing it to us.
Thank you for your interest. Great to be here.
Andrew Agapur is a scholar, a comedian, and the writer and producer of the one-person show, Zarah. Zarah premieres Thursday at PSI Theater at the Durham Arts Council, the performance followed by a panel discussion. And, of course, you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org, where you can also sign up for our newsletter and get a daily preview of our lineup. I think I'll do that because... be nice to know what's going to happen on the show from minute to minute. The State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley's our technical director, North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.